Chapter 33. Marissa. Marissa feels as if she is struggling through a swamp. The air around her is heavy and oppressive, and her limbs are leaden. She knew something horrible would happen tonight, and it has. First, Avery confronted her outside her home, demanding to talk. And then, when she pulled open the door, there stood Skip. Skip, whom she wasn't supposed to see until Monday, when Avery would provide her with the magical elixir to fix everything. Skip's presence in her house, beside her on the couch, close enough for her to smell his aftershave, is almost too much for her to bear. Does Matthew suspect? She steals a glance at her husband, who is telling a joke about politicians, gesturing with both hands and smiling broadly. This is their home. They created it together, not only with bricks and mortar, but by building layers of memories. They chart Bennett's growth on the door of his closet in different colored markers every year. They play board games, assemble puzzles, and watch movies in this very room. They've shared tears and hurt feelings and hugs. All the work they have done to create and repair not just their marriage, but their family, will be shattered in an instant if Matthew knows. She feels the heat of Skip's gaze on her again. He's acting so strangely. Why did he follow her into the kitchen and insist on carrying out the pitcher? Matthew had said Skip was a surprise guest. Why in the world would he pop by without an invitation?
I know I shouldn't say this, but I can't stop thinking about our night.
She blinks hard, and the image of those printed words disappears, only to be replaced by these.
I'm not letting you go so easily.
She tries to track the relaxed banter, but her mind is churning. She takes a sip of water as Matthew tells the punchline, and Avery and Skip laugh. Marissa has missed another beat. She watches Matthew lift his glass of wine and drink from it. Skip must have brought the same Argentinian Malbec over as he had the night she slept with him. She recognized the label when Matthew offered it to her. Why won't Skip just leave them alone? Her gaze drifts to the coffee table, where three children's games are stacked up. Pictionary, Scattergories, and a card game. Truth or Dare for Kids, reads the description on the box. Pretend to be a dog. Do you believe in ghosts? Do a crazy dance. Marissa's body is trembling. She can't be here for another minute. She has to get Skip and Avery out of her house now. At last, there is a break in the conversation, and she fakes a yawn. It's unlike her husband to miss a cue such as this. Normally, Matthew would find a way to gracefully end the evening, but he merely leans forward and grabs another handful of nuts. Avery takes the bait and stands. She looks from Matthew to Skip and then to Marissa. She hesitates for a moment. Marissa's throat thickens. She swallows back the surge of nausea. Don't leave me alone with them, she wants to cry out. Matthew begins to rise. He is a chivalrous host. Of course he will show Avery out, and Marissa will be left alone with Skip. But before Matthew can get to his feet, Avery says, Actually, Marissa, can we chat for a second? Marissa nods and follows Avery into the entryway. She has no idea what Avery wants from her. Why did she drop by tonight uninvited? Before Marissa can say a word, Avery begins.
When I leave, tell Matthew and Skip you don't feel well, that you are having some sort of reaction to the oil the masseuse used, that you need to excuse yourself, and then go directly upstairs.
But what about Bennett? What about dinner?
Marissa, your husband is a capable man. He'll figure it out. Besides, once Skip leaves, you will have a miraculous recovery and can recapture your family night.
Marissa nods. Okay. Avery leans in closer, her voice a whisper.
I know he's the guy.
Marissa rears back. Is it that obvious? Avery looks directly into Marissa's eyes, seeming to take measure of her. Does Avery suspect what else Marissa is hiding?
I'll need to see you tomorrow for another session.
Marissa swallows hard and nods. Of course, I can make myself available whenever you'd like. Avery nods crisply, as if that were a given. Marissa feels a rush of relief. Avery not only showed up at the best possible moment,
almost as if she intuited how desperately she would be needed, but she has also provided Marissa with an out tonight. Avery points toward the family room where the two men await. Now go. Marissa leans her head back against the hard porcelain tub, wishing the hot water would melt the coldness inside her. Downstairs, Matthew and Skip are probably still chatting, and she has no idea what Skip's agenda is in showing up here tonight. He'd said he would be in LA until Friday evening, so he must have come straight here from the airport. Regardless, they had an agreement to see each other on Monday at the coffee shop. Why would he change that plan without telling her? Matthew had said he'd put a frozen pizza in the oven for Bennett for dinner, which means he'll need to leave the living room to heat up the oven and pop in the pie, then again to take it out and call Bennett down to dinner. Those interruptions to his conversation with Skip might finally prompt Skip to leave. Marissa uses her toes to turn the tap down to a trickle and sinks lower into the water. The anonymous bouquet, the ominous note, Skip's uninvited appearance tonight. None of it seems true to character. These actions taken together and under the circumstances feel almost malicious, designed to inflict distress. While Skip would never be called a saint, in all the years she has known him, since she was 7 and Skip was 9, she can't think of a single time he acted deliberately cruelly. The only hurtful instance she can recall occurred when he seemingly rejected her after their kiss, during the summer that seemed to be on all of their minds tonight. Now that Avery knows the truth about Skip, Marissa can finally tell her the full story about the summer she kissed Skip but ended up as Matthew's girl. Marissa closes her eyes, getting the narrative straight in her head. The details remain so vivid that the scenes spring forward, fully formed. The rhythms of that season had shifted. Her parents deemed her old enough to close up Connor's, so several nights a week, Marissa ate dinner early at the kitchen table, then went to relieve her father. After she locked up the store, she would sometimes wander down to the shore to meet up with the other teens. The night she saw Skip with new eyes began as just another warm, languid evening. The moon was tucked behind clouds, so she used the small flashlight on her keychain to make her way down to the water, her flip-flops squeaking slightly with every step. Once she got closer to the beach, the light of the bonfire helped guide her, and she could hear the red-hot chili peppers blaring from a boombox. There was often alcohol, pilfered from parents' liquor cabinets or bought from the board clerk at the Stop and Save, and sometimes a little pot, too. Marissa occasionally sipped a wine cooler, but never drank more than one.
"Hey, Marissa," Tina called out. "Come here, we're about to start Truth or Dare."
Tina's speech was slurred, the way it always got when she was buzzed, something she'd been doing a lot more of that summer.
"Seems like the party started early tonight," Marissa called back, but by then Tina's attention was on twisting another can of Bud Light out of the plastic six-pack ring.
Marissa and Tina had been best friends through 8th grade, sharing clothes and makeup, stickers and secrets. But right before high school began, Tina's father moved away, and Tina's mom seemed to completely check out of parenting. Tina appeared to grow up overnight. Instead of wanting to be with Marissa, Tina started cutting classes, partying, and hanging out with some of the older kids. She already had a reputation, although no one knew how true the rumors were. As Marissa drew closer, she saw Skip standing there, a smile curling the edges of his mouth, holding firewood logs. His arms were flexed under the weight, and she could see the outline of his biceps beneath his old t-shirt. His face, being partly in the golden firelight and partly in shadows, made him look both familiar and somehow brand new. She smiled back, feeling a strange flutter in her stomach. Skip lifted up a log and tossed it on the fire, sending up a shower of sparks, then used a big stick to pull apart two pieces of wood, allowing more air to mix with the flames. Out of the corner of her eye, Marissa watched him work, struck by his physicality, his strong shoulders and biceps flexing as he lifted and pulled. Then he'd turned and smiled at her with a boyish grin that let her know he'd caught her watching. When she claimed a seat, she felt another flutter when Skip came to sit beside her.
"I'll go first," Tina cried, jumping to her feet. "Someone give me a dare."
The game progressed predictably. Kids usually accepted dares, running into the surf fully clothed, shotgunning beers, but a few selected truths. Then it was Marissa's turn. Usually Marissa picked truth, partly because she didn't have any big secrets, and partly because the dares got edgier as the game wore on. But tonight, something pushed her to say, "Dare.
Kiss one of the guys next to you,"
a girl giggled. Marissa pretended to hesitate, as if she were considering which boy to choose. She took another sip of her wine cooler for courage, then turned toward Skip. She leaned forward and closed her eyes. His lips were soft, and he smelled like suntan lotion and the wintergreen lifesavers he always carried in his pocket. The whole interaction lasted less than 5 seconds, but for Marissa, it changed everything. As the game continued, she was acutely aware of Skip. Skip, the boy she'd known forever, just inches away. She swore she felt his awareness of her, too. Tina also seemed to sense it. Marissa detected the heat of Tina's glare. Marissa had a hunch Tina liked Skip, but Tina seemed to like lots of guys. Skip wasn't hers to claim. Besides, the sting of Tina's abrupt withdrawal from Marissa's life hadn't abated. Tina abruptly stood up, even though it wasn't her turn.
"I dare myself to take off my shirt."
Guys hooted and cheered as Tina slowly lifted her top, first revealing her pale, soft stomach and then her bright pink bra. Marissa could barely fill out an A cup, and for a moment she was as awestruck as the boys by Tina's lush body. It hadn't been that long ago that Tina and she had stuffed socks in their training bras, giggling as they admired themselves in Marissa's bedroom mirror. A few of the kids clapped as Tina did a little shimmy. She stumbled briefly before catching her balance again.
"Dare you to take off your bra,"
shouted Jimmy Parsons, one of the rough boys who was a year ahead of Marissa. Instead of laughing and sitting back down, Tina slowly reached back with both hands. But she wasn't looking at Jimmy. Her eyes, outlined in a bright turquoise, were staring straight at Skip. Marissa heard the quick intake of breath of the guy on the other side of her. The tenor of the evening changed instantly, as if the darkness just beyond them had seeped into their circle of firelight.
"Do it, do it,"
Jimmy chanted.
"Do it,"
several other guys joined in. The boy's energy was palpable. It felt to Marissa as if a pack of wolves had picked up the scent of a rabbit. Tina was too impaired and too desperate for attention, even the wrong kind of attention. Marissa jumped up.
"Hey, Tina, why don't you have some water? Maybe it's time to go home."
"Who are you, the hall shark?"
one of the guys yelled, bringing up the nickname of the school monitor who kept tabs on the students.
"Come on, man."
Skip reached over and gave him a gentle punch on the shoulder.
"We've all seen her tits anyway,"
Jimmy said, leering.
"It takes one beer to kiss her, 2 beers to touch her, 3 beers to undress her, and 4 beers to fuck her."
More hooting and hollering came from the other boys, and Marissa watched as Tina crumpled, as if the words were stones raining down on her.
"Screw you!"
Tears streaked down Tina's face. She grabbed her shirt and began to run. They all watched her go, then Jimmy said,
"I didn't even get to what she does after 5 drinks,
which made everyone laugh except Marissa and Skip. The laughter must have carried to Tina. As Marissa watched Tina slip as she struggled to run in the soft sand, Marissa found herself thinking about how before Tina's parents divorced and the two girls would have sleepovers, Tina used to fall asleep snuggling a stuffed monkey. How utterly alone she must feel, Marissa thought. "One of us should get her home," Marissa whispered to Skip. "Make sure she's all right." Skip looked at her in surprise.
"Yeah?"
Marissa nodded. The thing swelling between her and Skip, it could wait.
"Do you want to go or should I?"
"Let's both go," Marissa decided. But that had been the wrong call. Of all the things Marissa regretted in life, this topped the list. She should have chased after Tina alone and hugged her and invited her to stay over again. Maybe then Tina would have been safe. Seeing Skip and Marissa together had only upset Tina more. She'd lashed out at them, then run away again. By the time Marissa unlocked her front door later that night, her parents were sound asleep. She slipped upstairs quietly, put her clothes in the hamper, and brushed her teeth. She lay awake for a long time, though. The next morning, she awoke much later than usual and headed into the kitchen. Both her mother and her father sat huddled at the small table whispering, which made no sense because who was manning this door? They lifted their heads and stared at her. She'd only seen them look that way, so pale and stricken, once before when her maternal grandmother had suddenly died of a heart attack. "What is it?" Marissa had gasped. "Sweetheart," her mother's voice caught. "We have some terrible news. Tina," her mother didn't continue. Maybe she couldn't, and Marissa felt her heart pound. Dread infused her.
"Tina was found dead,"
Marissa's father finally said.
"The police think she was murdered."
Marissa's legs buckled. Everything changed again, seemingly in an instant. The whole town went on high alert. No kids were allowed out alone, even in the daytime. Marissa's father closed up the store in the evenings while she stayed home with her mother and Luke. Details and rumors seeped out. Tina had been beaten to death. No, she'd been suffocated. Her body was found on a pile of rocks near the water. She'd been raped, or maybe she'd had consensual sex. She'd been discovered by an early morning fisherman, but had likely been killed around 10 the previous evening, shortly after she'd left the bonfire. The police questioned all the kids who'd been at the beach that night, including Marissa, who told them about Truth or Dare, Tina's drinking, and how she and Skip had gone after Tina and tried to console her, but she'd resisted, calling Marissa a bitch and physically lashing out at Skip and scratching his forearm, so they gave up. "Skip walked me home afterwards," Marissa had said. The detective nodded and jotted something down in his notebook. "So we were the last ones to see her alive?" Marissa had whispered. Marissa's father had placed a hand on her shoulder. He'd told the police there was no way they were going to talk to his teenaged daughter without him being present. The police detective had regarded her, expressionless.
"Other than the killer."
The phone rang all the time, bringing news from friends and neighbors, and Marissa's father carried home more information from the store's customers. A timeline emerged. Most of the kids stayed at the bonfire, continuing the games and drinking. After he walked Marissa home, Skip had apparently gone to Matthew's house, which seemed odd to Marissa since he and Matthew weren't close, and Skip had watched a movie with Matthew. Matthew's mother verified this, saying she'd brought the boys a bowl of popcorn and cans of soda. Everyone had an alibi, and besides, no one thought one of the teenagers was a murderer. A suspect emerged quickly. The English teacher at the high school, who'd always seemed a little creepy. 4 days later, everyone in town breathed a collective sigh of relief when the teacher was arrested for Tina's murder after he gave a full confession. The police found pictures of Tina and some of the other cheerleaders, taken surreptitiously at their practice, on his camera. A memorial service was held for Tina, but after the tears and the high school choir's rendition of Amazing Grace, it seemed as if she was quickly forgotten, as if the tide that had erased the traces of her footprints that night had also washed away memories of Tina herself. The beach bonfires resumed, though no one ever suggested playing Truth or Dare. By August, the paralyzing fog around Marissa finally yielded to a more manageable grief. She'd barely left the house, other than to lay flowers on Tina's grave, pink and purple bouquets, because those were Tina's favorite colors. But now Marissa began to venture out again and to resume working at the family store. Skip seemed different, though. Marissa hoped he'd seek out her company. More than that, she'd counted on it. But he never did. When she bumped into him, he was both friendly and remote. She told herself she'd imagined the spark between them. She had kissed him, not the other way around. Then in mid-August, Matthew came into Connor's to buy his mother coffee beans. Now Marissa looks down at the wedding band on her finger, then plunges her head down into the warm water.
Seeing those words on the card game, truth or dare, brought back so many memories, including the one of that first kiss. The spark she'd felt for Skip had never gone away. It had merely lain dormant until Skip's second kiss reignited it a few weeks ago. But she loves her husband. She made a choice long ago to commit to Matthew. Marissa's head breaks the surface just as Matthew knocks on the door.
Sweetie, you okay in there?
Yes, thanks.
Skip just left.
Marissa mentally wills a message to Avery. Thank you. I'll be down in a minute. I'm feeling better now.
Chapter 34. Avery. Gabe's Deli is a Washington, D.C. institution. Nestled between a copy shop and an upscale sneaker store, it's a hole in the wall, but the food is anything but ordinary. Gabe, the owner, has reimagined classic comfort dishes, mac and cheese, meatloaf, and chicken noodle soup, with a healthy twist. The ingredients are farm fresh, organic, and wholesome. The cashier by the front door, who doubles as a hostess, tells me there's a waiting list for a booth, but a few counter stools are open. I glance around the restaurant and thank her. The counter will do just fine. Guess that bowl of nuts didn't fill you up either, I comment to Skip, who is tapping a message into his phone on the next stool over. He looks startled, but recovers quickly. He must realize I followed him here when he left the Bishops. Maybe he even expected it on some level. Hey, Avery. I thank the waiter who slides a glass of water in front of me, and since I feel that I have to order something, I tell him I'll have a grilled cheese. I guess you've got a few questions for me. Skip swivels on his stool to face me. I take measure of him. Like Marissa, Skip seems a little ragged. He still needs that haircut, and the bright overhead lighting reveals a few lines in his face that I don't remember seeing before. Let's start with this one. What the hell is going on? Skip glances at his phone, then tucks it away. Fair enough. I'll just lay it out. I'm the one who sent Marissa to see you. I ran through a lot of outlandish premises in my mind on the drive here, but this isn't one I considered. That article about you in the Post magazine. I emailed it to Marissa and suggested she make an appointment. A friend forwarded it to me a while back. It's the reason I sought you out, Marissa had told me in our second session. So Marissa, who seemed so innocent at first, had lured her husband to the counselor her lover had suggested. For a woman who claims she has no more secrets, she sure conceals a lot. When? About a month ago, maybe a little longer. So right after you two slept together. I stare straight into his eyes as I deliver the words. She told you about us? I cut him off. I'm the one asking questions now. I'm not saying I don't believe you, but this doesn't make sense. Why in the world would you want the Bishops to come see me and try to fix their marriage when you're obviously in love with Marissa? Skip's eyes look hollow. I didn't expect Marissa would bring Matthew. I figured she'd go to the sessions alone. It still isn't computing. And then what would happen? You'd make her realize she needs to leave Matthew. I want to laugh, but Skip's expression is so bleak, I don't. Skip, Marissa loves Matthew. She wants to repair things with him. I can't make her realize anything she doesn't believe. That's not how this works. Skip opens his mouth, but before he can reply, the waiter moves to our end of the counter and tells Skip his order will be ready soon. Sorry for the delay, the kitchen's really backed up tonight. When the waiter moves away, Skip leans closer to me. Look, you were asking about the summer when Matthew said he fell in love with Marissa, but I loved her first. I was her first kiss, did she ever tell you that? I shake my head. I'm beginning to feel sorry for him. There's always been something between me and Marissa. That makes me sit up straighter. So that wasn't the first time you slept together? No, it was, just that once. I meant that you've always loved her. Skip, the man who has never married and may have difficulties with intimacy, given that I don't know of any long-term relationships he has had. He only went out with Natalie once, and even though I felt a connection to him and thought it might turn into something more, it was fleeting. I just want what's best for her, and Matthew isn't it. You need to let this go, Skip. Don't send Marissa flowers or call her again, and for God's sake, don't leave her anonymous notes. I don't... Skip cuts himself off as the waiter comes over again, this time holding 4 to-go bowls. He sets them on the counter in front of Skip, then begins stacking them in a paper bag with Gabe's logo on the front. Want saltines? Skip thinks for a second, then nods. Please. The waiter sticks several little packets into the bag. Actually, do you have any extra? Sure. The waiter adds another handful. Anything else? That'll do it, thanks. Careful, the soup's pretty hot. I look at the bag. 4 bowls of soup? Skip nods. Yeah, Marissa doesn't feel well. I'm bringing them back for her. The roses, the note, the phone calls, and now this? Skip isn't in love. He's obsessed. He glances at the bill the waiter has left on the counter and pulls out 2 20s, leaving them beneath his water glass. Skip, don't you think Matthew is capable of taking care of his wife? He doesn't need you to be the delivery boy. Skip flinches. He doesn't react with anger, though. He looks at me levelly. Didn't you notice how tired Marissa looked? Matthew didn't even care that she was going to carry that heavy water pitcher or go upstairs without dinner. She can't skip meals like that. His demeanor is at odds with his words. Skip is acting as if it were perfectly natural for him to be the primary person looking out for Marissa's well-being. Skip reaches for the handle of the bag. When Marissa was pregnant with Bennett, the only thing she could keep down was Gabe's chicken noodle soup. It's such a specific detail. How many other nuances of Marissa's life has he cataloged through the years? Now that Skip has Marissa's dinner in hand, I'm going to lose him. He's like a missile being guided straight back to her. I wonder if he'll leave the soup on the doorstep or ring the bell and try to go inside again. How long until Matthew catches on, I wonder. My plan for the Monday meeting at the coffee shop won't work now. There isn't anything Marissa will be able to say to convince Skip to let this go. He wants Marissa for himself. By his own admission, he has wanted her for 25 years, and based on his actions tonight, he isn't going to stop. I'm so caught up in my thoughts that it takes me a moment to process the layered meaning of Skip's words. When Marissa was pregnant with Bennett. Skip, you don't think Marissa is pregnant? Yes, I do. He stands up, his expression resolute. And I'm almost positive it's my baby.
Chapter 35. Marissa. Marissa scans the group gathered at North Chevy Chase Park, searching for a familiar face. Matthew would hate this, Marissa thinks, as one of the boys in Bennett's Cub Scout troop, wielding a stick like a spear, runs past her through a muddy puddle, screaming, "Kaya!" Or at least the old Matthew would have. Maybe the new one, who'd played scattergories with her and Bennett for 2 hours last night, and woke up early to make Bennett daddy pancakes, substituting M&Ms for Marissa's usual berries and chia seeds, wouldn't have minded at all. After Skip finally left their home and Marissa rejoined her family, it was as if the world tipped back onto its correct axis. Though Marissa still felt unmoored and shaky, Matthew and Bennett were filled with stories about their rocket launches, including Bennett's excited description of Matthew hoisting Bennett 20 feet high into a tree to retrieve the toy when it got stuck. By the time they'd all gathered around the game, Marissa had felt calm enough to nibble a slice of pizza and join in the laughter. The only off note came when Skip sent a group text to Matthew and Marissa to let them know he'd left some chicken soup on their doorstep for Marissa. The gesture seemed completely over the top, but Matthew merely read the message, then looked at Marissa and shrugged.
That's nice of him. Guess he was worried you were really sick.
Then he'd wrapped an arm around Marissa and pulled her closer. This morning, Matthew had seemed genuinely disappointed to miss the prep for the great outdoors event,
but a crisis had erupted at the office and he needed to go in for a couple of hours. That wasn't unusual. Matthew often worked on weekends. What was different was his promise to make it up to them.
I'm all yours as soon as I get back,
he'd said as he shrugged on his coat. She'd glanced at Bennett, then followed Matthew into the garage, hesitating as she carefully chose her next words.
Would it be okay with you if I invited Chris to the Cub Scout thing?
The event, with its focus on tent building and wood whittling, would be the perfect bonding opportunity for her handy father-in-law and his grandson. Plus, it would be nice for Bennett to have a male relative there, since so many boys came with their fathers. Bennett hasn't seen him since they went to see that last Spider-Man movie, she'd continued. Matthew didn't look up as he opened his car door. She held her breath, hoping she hadn't shattered their new equanimity as he seemed to come to a decision.
Sure,
he'd said quietly. He met her eyes over the roof of his car.
You know, I've been thinking maybe we could invite my dad over for dinner again sometime. Not for a special occasion or anything.
Was it possible that Matthew was changing the tenor of all the significant relationships in his life? She'd read about it in books and seen it in movies. A character who had a medical scare or near-death experience completely reevaluates his or her life. It was fairly common. She just never thought it would happen to Matthew. My infidelity with Skip might actually have saved my husband, Marissa had thought in wonder. Now Marissa watches Chris supervise Bennett as her son lays out tent stakes and poles and shakes out a bright blue tarp.
Lay it shiny side up, buddy,
Chris instructs Bennett. If it weren't for the way Chris treated Matthew, Marissa might actually like her father-in-law. As it is, her feelings toward him are mixed.
Okay, Gramps, Bennett replies. So the shiny side should face the shiny sun.
That's right. Now find the big pole that's going to hold up the tent. No, not that one. It's the one to the left.
Bennett lifts up both of his hands to see which index finger and thumb form the letter L, a trick he learned from a teacher. Out of the corner of her eye, Marissa spots a familiar figure approaching the park. She stiffens. I need to get something for my car, Marissa tells Chris. Would you mind watching Bennett for a bit? Chris waves her off, and Marissa hurries to intercept the new arrival. Chris's presence today serves a dual purpose, bonding with Bennett and affording her the chance to slip off unnoticed. The voices of the group fade as Marissa walks farther away toward the wooded area by the playground equipment. A few parents are pushing kids on swings or soaking in the sun on benches, but no one takes any notice of Marissa as she passes by to where Avery waits. Thanks for meeting me, Marissa begins. Seeing Avery here brings the tumult of last night rushing back and Marissa's stomach twitches. We've got a lot to cover, so talk fast. Avery folds her arms. What happened after I left? Marissa fills Avery in on everything. Her soak in the tub and the memories of that summer, the games and the soup delivery. From her position in the park, Marissa can't see Bennett or Chris. She is gripped with the same irrational fear she felt right after her massage, the one that compelled her to rush to Bennett's side. He's fine, she tells herself. He's with Chris, and Chris knows how to handle himself. At 70, he has the strength of many men half his age. Chris doesn't go to a gym or play golf or tennis, but whenever there's manual labor to be done, 50-pound bags of mulch to spread around his yard or a dead tree that needs to be cut down, he works unceasingly until the job is complete. Because Avery doesn't react when Marissa tells her about the soup delivery, Marissa keeps talking nervously. I know I shouldn't have lied to you about Skip, but I never thought he'd become such a big problem. Marissa realizes she is wringing her hands together, and she forces herself to stop. What is it? No more secrets. Marissa clears her throat. The note that was slipped under Coco's door. I reviewed the security camera footage and recognized the person who delivered it. Marissa can't see Avery's eyes beneath Avery's dark sunglasses. It's impossible to know how she is feeling. Avery fired her as a client once before. Now that she knows Marissa has been keeping more information concealed, will she walk away again? Marissa is in too deep. She has to keep going. No more secrets. It was a man named Ray. He's homeless, and he often sits on a bench down the street from my store.
I talked to him and he told me someone had paid him to do it.
Who?
Ray didn't get a name.
And?
Avery snaps. And in addition to paying Ray, he gave Ray his gloves. I recognized them because they're the same gloves I bought Skip for Christmas.
How do you know they're the same pair?
They're blue leather. They're very distinctive. Avery is silent for a moment.
Did you ever doubt it was Skip who left that note?
Marissa shakes her head. No. The moment I saw it, I knew. Marissa wishes Avery would remove her glasses so she could gauge her expression.
I'm going to ask you something really personal now,
Avery finally says. Marissa nods. She resists the urge to look back and crane her head to try to glimpse Bennett through the trees.
Are you pregnant?
What? Marissa gasps. No, why would you think such a thing?
You're sure?
I'm positive. Marissa is not going to explain the details of her cycle to Avery, but she can say with 100% certainty this is true. Marissa's cell phone vibrates in her pocket, but she ignores it.
Well, I have a feeling someone suspects you are.
Who? Marissa begins to ask, but the word dies on her lips. The image of the opaque CVS bag, the one that contained her pregnancy test, bursts into her mind.
Polly, did she tell you I was?
Why would Polly think that?
After Skip and I, well, I knew the odds were very slim given my fertility issues, but I had to make sure. So I picked up a test and used it at work. The result was negative, but then Polly started acting strangely. She wouldn't even let me pick up a pillow. I finally got it out of her that she saw the kit in the trash can. By the time Marissa has finished recounting the story, Avery is shaking her head.
So you explained to your overly solicitous assistant that you aren't pregnant?
Yes, and she appeared to believe me.
Did she tell you otherwise?
Marissa's heart is pounding. She is so angry that if Polly were here, she'd not only fire her on the spot, she'd have trouble restraining herself from slapping Polly across the face.
Have Polly and Skip ever met?
Polly and Skip? Marissa feels dizzy under the onslaught of questions. She doesn't want to be here, trying to untangle the horrible mess she's created. She should be with her son, watching him pitch a tent for the first time. If only she hadn't answered her phone that night when Skip had called, saying he was in the neighborhood. If only she'd said she was tired instead of telling him to stop by, that Matthew was out of town, but she'd love to catch up. If only she hadn't drank half the bottle of wine he'd brought. Marissa forces herself to consider Avery's question. Marissa needs to make sure the information she gives is true. No, Polly hasn't worked for me long. Skip has never been to the store during that time, at least that I know about. The sun dips behind a cloud. The young-looking father sitting on the bench stands up and collects his children, leaving only a woman pushing a baby in a stroller back and forth. The baby is crying, a tired, drawn-out sound that borders on a whine. His noises are drowning out the faint voices of the Cub Scouts, and Marissa quashes the urgent desire to run back to Bennett. Avery shifts topics.
Polly said someone has been calling the store and hanging up when she answers. It's pretty obvious who the mystery caller is. Is it possible that he didn't hang up once? That he and Polly spoke?
Marissa shrugs. I have no idea, truly. She feels her cell phone vibrate in her pocket again. Sorry. She pulls it out and stares down at the notification. Another missed call. There's no name for the contact. Marissa erased it weeks ago, but she recognizes the number as Skip's. Marissa's chest tightens. It's him again.
Don't answer. Until I figure out how to handle Skip, I don't want you to talk to him.
Marissa turns the screen so Avery can see it. Along with the missed call is a text.
Just checking in to see how you're feeling.
Why is he so worried about... Marissa's hand flies to her mouth. Oh my God, she whispers as the realization hits her. Avery's personal question, Skip's over-attentiveness, Gabe's chicken soup. Skip thinks I'm... A child's shriek cuts through the air. Just as Marissa could pick Bennett from a lineup based on scent, she can recognize his cry even from this distance. Bennett, I've got to go. She races back toward the makeshift campground. In the time she's been gone, how long could it have been? 7 minutes? 10 tops, she assures herself. A medley of tents have been constructed, and the scouts, in their identical uniforms, are swarming around. Where's her son? She thinks frantically.
Finally, she spots the back of Chris's hunter green jacket. He is huddled with a few other adults, including the troop leader. Bennett is in the center of the group. Bennett! He turns around. He is pressing a handkerchief to his thumb.
I don't think he needs stitches, do you?
She can hear the leader asking as he opens a first aid kit. Marissa's pulse slows. Bennett isn't badly hurt. He isn't even crying.
What happened, sweetie? Did you cut yourself whittling?
This is going to sting just for a second, okay?
The troop leader, peeling back the handkerchief, tells Bennett. Marissa leans over and puts her hand on Bennett's shoulder. She wants to take him in her arms, but the other children are watching, and she knows Bennett is trying to keep his composure. The leader pours a bit of iodine on the cut, then begins to bandage it up.
Next time, you'll use a regulation pocket knife, right?
The troop leader winks at Bennett.
I don't understand. Bennett has a regulation knife.
Chris clears his throat.
He was using mine.
Marissa sees the pocket knife on the grass. Its blade is longer and likely much sharper than the one used by the scouts. Chris reaches over and picks it up, using the palm of his hand to fold the blade back in. She quashes a surge of irritation. Naturally, Chris would give Bennett a bigger knife and expect him to know how to use it. It's the sort of thing Chris did to Matthew all the time growing up. Matthew had once told her that while he was still in elementary school, his father expected him to take over mowing the vast lawn of their home.
Luckily, my mom hired a mowing service to come once a week while my dad was at work,
Matthew had said, laughing.
He never knew.
Now, Marissa straightens up and the other parents begin to drift away. That's when Marissa sees Avery has joined them. She has finally removed her sunglasses and appears to be taking everything in.
Why don't we skip whittling for today? Marissa suggests to Bennett. You can make up the lesson when your thumb feels better.
He's fine,
Chris interjects.
Better to get back on that horse.
Bennett picks up the stick and winces. Marissa's jaw clenches, but her tone remains cordial.
I think we should call it a day. Why don't we take Bennett out for some ice cream?
Ice cream?
Bennett's face lights up. Chris shakes his head.
Can't believe his dad didn't teach him how to at least open a pocket knife.
In the frozen moment that follows Chris's harsh words, Marissa witnesses the troop leader avert his eyes and Bennett's face turn crestfallen. Avery, as always, seems to catalog every detail. Anger swells inside Marissa. The old Marissa would have swallowed her ire. She would have glossed over the moment, pretending it had never happened, to save face in front of the troop leader and other parents. Her need for pleasing appearances would have trumped her need for authenticity. No more, she thinks as she glares at Chris. Matthew isn't the only one who is changing the tenor of all of his relationships. When Marissa speaks, her voice is lower than usual. Don't you ever talk that way about Matthew again. Surprise briefly flashes across Chris's face.
Come on, Bennett. You can show me how to take down the tent.
Marissa deliberately excludes Chris, shifting her body so that her back is to him.
As they walk away, she thinks, my infidelity with Skip might actually have saved me, too.
Chapter 36, Avery. I'm unlocking my car door when footsteps crunch against the ground behind me. I spin around to see Marissa's father-in-law, nearly close enough to touch. Chris is built like a wrestler, broad and compact. His thick white hair is buzzed short, his skin is weathered, and he wears a hunter green windbreaker and well-worn khakis. Aside from his light blue eyes, he looks nothing like his tall, polished son. Chris smiles tightly. I feel instantaneous dislike, and not just because of the way he insulted Matthew a few minutes ago. He extends his hand, and after a moment I take it and feel the rough calluses on his palm.
I'm Chris Bishop. What was your name again?
Again. A strange choice of words. It's as if in his mind we've already been introduced. The moment almost feels like a mirror image of last night when Skip pretended we'd never met. Avery. I decide not to offer my last name, although I'm not exactly sure why. He nods, his eyes intent.
You're friends with my daughter-in-law?
I'd said goodbye to Marissa, but since she was busy with Bennett, I hadn't lingered. Chris must have been watching her closely to have observed our brief interaction. Friend of a friend. It's my default answer when I see a client in public. I pull my hand away from Chris's and open my car door.
Nice to meet you.
I experience a brief flash of deja vu. Those were the exact words Skip uttered to me last night, even though he and I were far from strangers. Although I've done a little research on Chris as part of my work with the Bishops, I know the name of his lobbying company and where he lives, I haven't considered him worthy of much attention. Now I wonder if I should take a closer look at him. The mother-daughter dynamic gets a lot of coverage, but the father-son relationship is equally complicated. In my years as a therapist and now as a consultant, I've learned that if a son has a strained relationship in his present life, it's not unusual for it to be traced to a past dysfunction with his father. I watch as Chris climbs into a LeSabre parked across the lot from me. I wait a few minutes, wanting him to drive off first. But even though I see clouds of exhaust coming out of his tailpipe, indicating the engine is on, the vehicle doesn't move. Perhaps Chris is making a phone call. I decide to make one, too. Marissa had said Matthew was at his office, but I dial Matthew's cell number anyway, thinking that it's still probably the most efficient way to reach him. It rings three times, and I wonder if he really had a work emergency or, and this could be me projecting, if it was merely an acceptable excuse to avoid the rambunctious Cub Scout event. Then he picks up, sounding a bit out of breath. Hey, I'm glad I caught you. I watch Chris's car out of my rearview mirror as I speak. It still isn't moving. I know you're at the office, but I was hoping we could chat.
I'm really crazed, Avery. Can this wait?
It won't take long. It's about something that came up last night. Matthew hesitates. I'm actually downtown already, I fib. How about we meet at Giovanni's for a quick coffee? I name Matthew's regular takeout place, the restaurant where I saw Polly. When he doesn't immediately reply, I say firmly, "It's important." Matthew gives a little laugh.
Okay, you caught me. I lied to Marissa. I'm not actually at work.
You've got to be kidding me, I think.
I'm at the wharf. If you really need to talk now, come here.
Typically, in the cases I take on, I act as a funnel for clients. Their problems seem overwhelming and chaotic at first, but as we chip away at their situation, their issues distill into manageable entities. With the Bishops, it's the opposite. For our seventh session, Exposure, I'm splitting the time between Marissa and Matthew. The wharf is set on the Potomac River, and in the summer it's usually full of tourists and residents alike. There's everything from restaurants to shops to a Ferris wheel. Today, some people are milling around, but it's too early in the year for the crowds. The area Matthew directed me to is quiet. A dozen vessels ranging from catamarans to big sailboats line both sides of a long wooden pier. Most of the boats are winterized, covered up to protect them from the elements until warmer days arrive. A few men are working on the edge of the dock, and another is tinkering with something on his sleek-looking cigarette boat. I stand at the spot Matthew directed me to, an outdoor bar called the Watering Hole, which is closed now, and see him waiting for me by the end of the pier, standing with his back to the Potomac. I walk toward him. He looks boyish, with his wind-ruffled hair and wide-open smile. It's as if a weight he has been carrying around is finally slipping off his back. Surprise, he says, then does something that truly takes me off guard. He opens his arms and envelops me in a brief, hard hug. When he releases me, he turns and gestures to the boat behind him. It's beautiful, with its glossy wood detail against the gleaming white fiberglass hull. You bought this? Matthew shakes his head. He can't seem to stop grinning.
But it's mine for the weekend. Tomorrow is our anniversary. 12 years. Marissa thinks we're going to some fancy restaurant, but I'm bringing her down here for a catered dinner and moonlight sail. Want to take a look?
He motions for me to kick off my shoes and step aboard. Picture a table for two right here, with poached lobster and champagne from the year we were married. He gestures. I've got a playlist on my phone, songs that mean something to us. blankets in case it gets cold, and I've arranged for Bennett to spend the night with his friend Charlie. She's going to love it, right?
I would imagine so. But I'm beginning to wonder if this is what Marissa truly desires.
Let me show you the rest.
We climb down 6 steep, narrow steps into the cabin, where there's a bedroom, bathroom, and living room. The spaces are tiny, but everything is beautifully appointed.
Can I get you anything? Marissa loves these grapefruit seltzers, or there's orange juice. I just stocked the fridge.
No, thanks. I take a seat on the curved banquette. Matthew sits opposite me.
So, I'm seeing you twice in 2 days. Last night was fun, right?
I wouldn't categorize the evening as fun, exactly, but I nod.
I'm glad you had a chance to meet Skip. He's been an important part of our lives forever. He knows a lot about boats, and he's actually helping me arrange all this.
Matthew sweeps out his arm. I think back to the yellow roses ordered through the anonymous Venmo account at Pier1234. I need to tread carefully as I peel back the protective layers in Matthew's mind, the ones that keep him from recognizing the truth about his good friend and his wife. Exposure is a delicate process.
So you and Skip are close?
Matthew shrugs.
Yeah, I mean, he and Marissa are like brother and sister. Their parents have been friends forever, so I guess I inherited him.
Matthew's tone is affectionate. Does he truly not see that Skip is in love with his wife? I don't want to lead him to the conclusion I've already formed. It'll be more powerful if Matthew recognizes it for himself. I've been working with Marissa about acknowledging the ugly underbelly of the different situations and relationships she navigates. Matthew has been complicit in creating a beautiful but vacant picture of their life together. His anniversary dinner is the equivalent of a dieter buying a treadmill, a splashy statement that will do absolutely no good unless the gesture turns into a routine. What I'm about to learn is whether Matthew is ready for some fundamental changes. I can tell Skip really cares about Marissa. The tiniest off note is in my tone, but it's up to Matthew to choose whether he wants to hear it. He nods and begins to speak. Then he cuts himself off and turns to face me.
You sound like there's something else you want to say.
His buoyancy is vanishing. The smile has dropped from his face. I can't bring up the supposed pregnancy or the soup because then Matthew will know I've talked to Marissa or Skip. But I don't have to because Matthew didn't really think there was something else I wanted to say. He meant there was something he wanted to talk about. I let the silence stretch out until he breaks it.
Okay, here's the truth about Skip.
I hear a creaking sound, as if the boat is rubbing against a piling, but I don't take my eyes off Matthew.
Last night, after you guys left, he texted that he'd brought Marissa some soup. At first I thought, that's nice. You know, good old Skip, always looking out for his friends.
Baby waves rock the boat, making a gentle slapping sound each time they hit. In the distance, what sounds like a jet ski cruises by, the roar of the motor swelling and then fading. Matthew's gaze grows unfocused. It's almost as if he were talking to himself now.
I didn't get the soup off the porch right away. We'd already eaten and Marissa was feeling better. I went out there when Marissa was putting Bennett to bed.
As I picture Matthew treading onto his front porch in the darkness and spotting the carrier with Gabe's logo, I hear something. It sounds as if it's coming from the deck where Matthew plans to serve his romantic dinner. A footstep? I glance up toward the mouth of the stairs, but don't see anyone. Sound travels over water, I remind myself. Maybe the noise is coming from farther away. Still, I shift my body to have a clear view of the stairs. Matthew is so lost in the memory of last night that he doesn't even seem to notice.
The bag was heavy, and when I looked inside, there was a hell of a lot of soup.
After I put it all away and went upstairs, Marissa was already asleep. I guess the massage really conked her out.
Normally, I'm out when my head hits the pillow, but last night I lay awake.
I kept thinking about something Natalie once said. Matthew's leg begins to jiggle, then he stills it. After I set her up with Skip and we all went to dinner, she told me it was obvious Skip had a crush on Marissa. I figured Natalie was jealous. She's always been jealous of Marissa. I wait for more. I know there's more. But Skip went all the way to this restaurant in Silver Spring and bought her 4 bowls of chicken noodle soup. Matthew shakes his head. Who does that? Someone who really cares about my wife. Matthew finishes the sentence, echoing the words I lobbed earlier with a heavy emphasis on the word really. Matthew is easing his toes into icy water. He's not ready to fully plunge in yet. Matthew twists to look directly at me.
So what should I do?
Our boat rocks again. Through the small windows above the banquette, I see the cigarette boat putter by. I watch as it glides out into the open water and accelerates, sending up a spray of water. When you've been married a while, it can feel nice to know you're attractive to someone other than your spouse, I tell Matthew.
I'm not blaming Marissa for the way Skip feels.
I'm not talking about Marissa. I'm talking about you. He blinks. Natalie has feelings for you. Skip has feelings for Marissa. And neither of them has any place in your marriage. Matthew nods slowly.
I get it.
I stand up, feeling a little claustrophobic in the tight space. I keep my feet apart for balance as another, slightly bigger wave rocks the boat. We could dig deeper, but I'm overcome with the desire to end our talk. I want to get off this boat. But Matthew isn't done. For a guy who was furious at his wife for tricking him into coming to see me, he sure has embraced the process wholeheartedly.
I'm going to let you in on a little secret. Skip was Marissa's first kiss. It was right before she and I started dating.
Marissa has already told me this, but I feign surprise. Matthew looks down at his hands and clears his throat. It's the most vulnerable I've ever seen him.
Last night, the main thing that kept me awake was thinking about that summer. I've never told this to anyone, but sometimes I wonder if all that drama hadn't happened, maybe Skip and Marissa would be together instead of us.
Drama?
One of Marissa's friends was killed.
I don't give away that I already know this information. Tina was murdered more than 20 years ago. So why does her death keep coming up?
Why would you think that? I ask. I'm pretty sure Skip liked Marissa even back then. But after the murder, well, to hear Marissa tell it, Skip started acting strangely. I guess it really threw him that this girl he'd known for his whole life had been killed by one of their teachers.
I want to sit down again to encourage Matthew to continue to be open, but a deep-seated instinct is keeping me on my feet instead of trapped behind the banquette.
What about you? Were you upset? Honestly, a little. I guess mostly because of the realization that something like that could happen. We all hung out at the beach, but I never got to really know her. She wasn't my type. She could be a little wild.
Matthew hesitates. Again, I wait.
Tina actually had a thing for Skip. That's what Marissa says. The night she died.
Matthew cuts himself off. What happened the night she died?
Matthew shrugs. Look, I'm not really sure. You know how people are. Everyone had crazy theories about what happened to Tina. But the truth came out, and Marissa and I ended up together, so...
He spreads out his hands, as if it were the end of the story. It isn't for me, though. I'm about to dig for more when I spot a blur of motion out of the corner of my eye. Matthew, is someone else on the boat?
Huh? No, not that I know of.
By the time he's finished answering, I'm at the stairs. I scramble up the first two, then my foot slips on the third narrow wedge of wood, and I have to grab the railings hard to keep from falling. I climb the rest of the way a little more slowly and land on the deck, blinking as direct sunlight hits my eyes. I spin around, trying to look in all directions, but for a few moments I'm blinded. When my vision returns, I scan my surroundings, but all the bobbing boats obscure clear sightlines. I glance at the vessels on either side of us, thinking that someone might have hopped into one, but they appear to be empty. Then I see a man jogging off the end of the pier and heading toward Pearl Street. He's moving at a good clip, and his back is to me. Matthew comes up to join me.
Look, no one else is here.
Someone was, though. I strain to catalog details about the man, but he's too far away. The wharf is even quieter now. The men who were working must be taking a lunch break. If someone was creeping around our boat, it must have been him. I point. Did you see that guy when you first got here? I turn to Matthew. He is watching me with a concerned expression. Behind him is a vast, open expanse of water.
I don't see anyone.
I turn back again and realize the man must have already turned the corner or disappeared into one of the few open restaurants. I slip on my shoes and reach into my purse for my sunglasses. I've got to go. How much longer are you planning to stay?
I'm actually about to go, too. I just need to take care of a quick thing here, and then I'm going to pick up a few more items for tomorrow night and head home.
One more question. Do the police have any more leads on who might have attacked you?
Matthew shakes his head.
His bandage is gone now. The only evidence of his assault is a faint bruise near his hairline.
Not that I know of. Since I couldn't identify anyone out of the lineup, they weren't able to make an arrest.
I say goodbye and walk down the pier, taking in deep breaths of the cold, fresh air. As I head up the ramp and pass over the retaining wall, I think about various scenarios. Someone could have followed me here. I already know, thanks to the man who came after me in the garage and the fake client who entered my home, that Acelia employs far-reaching ways to get to me. Or maybe Matthew was the target. Someone could have crept onto the boat hoping to find him alone. I'm still not convinced that random attack against Matthew was purely random. Anyone can be hired to do just about anything to us. Even Ray, the homeless guy who hangs out near Marissa's store, was paid to deliver a threatening note. I take a final look behind me. Matthew is still standing there, watching me go. Or maybe he's just taking in the air, too. I'm passing by the watering hole when I spot a small white object in the path the jogger just traced. It's probably nothing. Still, I veer left and pick it up. It's a slip of paper, folded in half. It's a bit crumpled, but it looks too pristine to have been here for longer than a few minutes. When I unfold it, I see the name and address of a restaurant called the Whistler Bar and Grill printed on top. It's in D.C. on 16th Street. Lower down, in the middle of the receipt, two charges are listed. Clooney and soda, $6.99. Then again, Clooney and soda, $6.99. It's the brand of cheap scotch that Matthew said his father drinks.
Chapter 37. Marissa. Now go wash that chocolate mustache off your face before it becomes permanent, Marissa teases Bennett as she unlocks the door leading from the garage to the kitchen.
You're home,
Matthew calls out, getting up from a stool at the Granite Island where he has been reading the newspaper. He's wearing jeans and an old sweatshirt, and his cheeks look a little ruddy. He seems relaxed and happy. Marissa supposes he solved the work crisis.
How was the Cub Scout thing?
Matthew ruffles Bennett's hair. Before Bennett can answer, Matthew spots the gauze wrapped around Bennett's finger.
What happened to your hand?
Bennett glances over at Marissa, then down at his sneakers and shrugs.
What happened?
Matthew repeats, this time asking Marissa. Marissa walks around to the other side of the island and sets down her purse on the stool next to the one Matthew just vacated so she can avoid her husband's eyes. Just a little cut. The last thing she wants to do is to explain to Matthew that his father had given their 8-year-old an adult-sized pocket knife. Not when it seems as if Matthew's icy feelings toward Chris are just beginning to thaw.
Plus, she knows this admission will inevitably lead to questions about how Marissa, who should have been by their son's side, but was instead a couple hundred yards away talking to Avery, allowed it to happen.
"It's not a big deal. I didn't even cry," Bennett chimes in.
Marissa looks at Bennett's sweet face and feels bile rise in her throat. She and Bennett have formed an unspoken alliance. They're complicit in a lie. Kids are perceptive. They model what their parents do, not what they say. What is she teaching her son? She isn't being a good role model for him at all, especially not today, when she's seething with anger toward Polly and trying to put on a happy face for her family. Marissa promises herself she will clean this up later and explain the full story to Matthew, but in the moment, she merely nods. He's okay. All she can think about is getting to Coco and confronting her big-mouthed, interfering, infuriating assistant. She can't be drawn into a long discussion now, or she'll crack under the pressure of her mood.
"So what's on the agenda for this afternoon?"
Matthew asks. "Look, do you guys mind if I run out for a bit?" Marissa gives Matthew a wink. "I want to pick up something from the store to wear tomorrow night."
"No problem."
Matthew turns to Bennett.
"So, should we start your dinosaur diorama or finish Star Wars?"
"Star Wars!" Bennett shouts.
"I'll be back before Princess Leia and Han Solo get trapped in the trash compactor." Matthew waves her off as Bennett runs into the family room and grabs the remote control.
"I got this."
Marissa smiles as Matthew settles down next to Bennett, slinging an arm over the back of the couch. She picks up her purse and heads out through the kitchen door into the garage. The smile immediately vanishes from her face. She drives directly to Coco, not hitting a single red light, making it to the store in near record time and instantly finding a parking spot, as if the fates are on her side, propelling her forward. She yanks open the door to Coco and spots Polly by the sunglass display with a customer. Polly gives Marissa a little wave, as if everything is business as usual. It takes every ounce of her self-control for Marissa not to storm over.
"Your face is a soft oval shape, so you can get away with oversized frames. The aviators would also look really good on you. Let me get you a hand mirror," Polly offers as the customer picks up a few pairs.
Marissa waits, fuming, but her hot wash of fury is finally cooling. It isn't that she is considering forgiving Polly for everything. If Polly really did tell Skip she thought Marissa could be pregnant, as Avery had seemed to insinuate, and who else would have given Skip that idea, then simply firing Polly won't be enough. The anger that made Marissa feel out of control is morphing into something more powerful, more dangerous, an icy, finely honed rage.
"I love both pairs on you," Polly enthuses to the customer. "Ooh, do you want to try these Gucci ones too? They're iconic."
Marissa's senses feel heightened. She is acutely aware of Nora Jones's smooth, rich voice playing over Coco's speakers and the tangy apricot scent of the lit candle on the nearby table. Yet Marissa's focus has never felt more acute. It's as if she has tunnel vision. All she can see is Polly with her shiny rose-colored lip gloss and tucked in the front shirt, chattering with the customer and occasionally shooting Marissa a quick look, seemingly delighted by her boss's attention. "I want to erase you from my life," Marissa thinks.
"Would you like to step outside to see what you prefer in the natural light?" Polly suggests.
Marissa smooths her hair and walks over to the customer. "I personally would go with these polarized ones. They're perfect on you, and I think you'll find you can see everything more clearly." Marissa locks eyes with Polly as she speaks. The obsequious grin falls away from Polly's face, and her expression turns to confusion. Finally, the customer selects the pair Marissa suggested, and as Polly rings her up, Marissa glances around to make sure no other customers are present. She glimpses herself in a full-length mirror, still in the cropped camo pants she wore to Bennett's Cub Scout event. They're a little baggy on her now, and with a smear of mud on the side of one of her old sneakers. A few weeks ago, she would never have considered coming to her store dressed like this. Today, she simply doesn't care.
"I hope you love them," Polly calls as the customer exits, setting the bell over the door, jingling merrily.
Marissa walks over to face Polly and jabs a finger at her, stopping just an inch or two away from Polly's chest as she unleashes her first question. "Why are you gossiping about me?" Polly's face crumples.
What are you talking about?
"Come on, Polly, Drop the act. You told my friend Skip. A familiar voice coming from the rear of the store interrupts her. How is Skip? Marissa spins around, feeling disoriented. Coco was empty, save for her and Polly. Marissa is certain of it. Even the curtain of the dressing room was drawn open. The only place someone could have been in is the back area, which is off limits to customers. Natalie is strolling toward her, holding two large shopping bags with Coco's logo. Hello, Marissa. Marissa blinks a few times, feeling a little dizzy. Natalie is acting as if she has every right to be here. She sauntered out of the back room and greeted Marissa as if she were the owner of Coco, and Marissa were someone who'd just wandered in off the street. What are you doing here? Marissa's voice is shaking. I came to pick up the auction items. Natalie lifts up the bags. We were all supposed to drop them off at the school yesterday, remember? Marissa finds her backbone. Obviously, I didn't remember, or else I would have done it. Natalie smiles, seemingly pleased she provoked a rise in Marissa. Look, it's okay. Her tone is sugary sweet and a touch condescending. You seem like you've been under a lot of stress lately, so I decided I would just come get them myself. No biggie. Marissa watches as Natalie sets down the bags and runs her hand over a faux fur throw draped over the back of an accent chair. The gesture seems oddly proprietary. Marissa whirls back around to face Polly. What is wrong with you? You let a stranger into the back of my store? Before Polly can answer, Natalie, her full lips curving up into a smile, steps closer to Marissa. Marissa, I don't know why you're getting so bent out of shape. I'm not a stranger to Polly. Natalie smiles at Polly, who gives her a tentative smile back. Marissa feels as if her head is going to explode. Natalie and Polly know each other? In fact, I'm the reason Polly is working here. Marissa's legs feel wobbly. This can't be true. She vividly recalls the first time she met Polly. Polly wandered into Coco, gushing about how much she loved the store. Polly knowledgeably discussed the hand-stitched detail on the decorative pillows and the thread count of the luxurious bedsheets. She asked if Marissa had ever considered hiring an assistant. Marissa's former employee had just left for another job, a higher-paying one at Saks. Polly's timing was impeccable. You two are friends? Marissa's head swivels between the women. But even before she finishes asking the question, she knows Natalie is telling the truth. Natalie had offered up a clue. Why did Marissa never follow up on it?
I wouldn't have let just anyone in the back, but I knew you had all the auction stuff there, and I was with that customer when Natalie showed up, Polly explains.
I've got to run. Natalie scoops up her bags and heads toward the door.
See you soon.
Marissa watches her go, then twists back to look at Polly. Polly appears on the verge of tears.
I'm sorry, she blurts.
Marissa isn't swayed by Polly's meek act, if it is an act. Marissa's phone vibrates in the side pocket of her camo pants, but she ignores it. There is no one she wants to talk to at this moment other than Polly. Natalie suggested you work here?
No, that's not how it happened. I was temping for the real estate agency where she worked before I started here.
Polly's words come out in a rush.
My dad's old college roommate is a bigwig there. He hired me. I was a receptionist, and it was only for a couple weeks. They really didn't need me. He was just doing my dad a favor.
That would be a plausible reason for leaving it off her resume, Marissa concedes.
But I didn't know Natalie well at all. She was mostly out showing houses. I just saw her a few times when she stopped by the office. I figured it was a total coincidence when she showed up today.
Marissa's phone buzzes again, just once, tickling her thigh. She folds her arms across her chest. Go on.
But Natalie acted like she expected to see me here. She gave me a hug, as if we were friends, and said her daughter went to the same school as Bennett. She told me she'd come to pick up the auction items. I thought you knew she was dropping by.
Marissa almost believes Polly. Almost. But there's a giant hole in her assistant's story. If you and Natalie barely knew each other, why would she tell you about the job opening here?
She didn't. That's the strange thing.
Polly looks bewildered.
My dad's friend, I think he's Natalie's boss. Anyway, he's the one who told me to apply here. I had no idea you and Natalie knew each other.
Marissa sinks into the accent chair, her mind whirling. Natalie must have told her boss that Polly could be a good fit for Coco. It's possible she knew Marissa's old assistant had moved on. Marissa had asked a few other moms at the school if they knew anyone who might be interested in working at Coco, and perhaps word had spread to Natalie. But why wouldn't Natalie have ever mentioned this connection to Marissa? Polly clears her throat.
Are you mad I let her take the auction stuff?
Marissa bites back a harsh laugh. Polly's query is so off the mark, it's ridiculous. Let's go back to the question our mutual friend Natalie interrupted. Why have you been gossiping about me to Skip? Polly spreads out her hands.
I don't know anyone named Skip, I swear it, Marissa.
Liar or cunning actress, Marissa thinks again. Natalie could be the link between Skip and Polly. Hadn't Skip just said last night that Natalie might be involved with the sales of his townhomes?
I could never do anything to hurt you, Marissa. The truth is, I haven't just been looking after the store. I've been trying to look after you.
Marissa wants to scream.
I don't need you to look after me.
Polly wipes her eyes.
Please don't be mad at me. It isn't my fault.
Marissa grits her teeth. The promising candidate from GW is coming in on Monday, she reminds herself. Marissa will hire her even if she's less than ideal. Anyone would be better than Polly. The store phone rings.
I'll get it,
and Polly turns. No, the word comes out harshly. Polly, we're not done talking. Marissa rises and walks to the checkout desk, thinking, if Skip is the one who kept trying my cell and is now calling the store, I will completely lose it. The number on caller ID flashes. It's her home line. She snatches up the receiver. Matthew?
Hey, I tried you on your cell, but you didn't pick up. Were you in my home office earlier?
No, why?
The cleaning woman wasn't here, was she?
No, she never comes on Saturdays. What's wrong?
Did you leave the window behind my desk open?
Of course not. Marissa rarely goes into Matthew's first floor office. The last time she did, it was just before their date at Mon Ami Gabi, and she would certainly never leave the window open. One of Matthew's prized possessions is a small original Picasso sketch that his mother gifted to him when he graduated from law school. It hangs between the two windows in the room. If moisture got through to it, the artwork could be damaged.
I just went in there to grab my laptop because Bennett wanted to look up dinosaur pictures for his diorama. The window was open a couple inches.
Oh my God, did someone break in while we were all out?
My laptop was on my desk and everything else seemed the same. Hang on, let me check upstairs.
Marissa holds her breath as she hears Matthew's quick footsteps thudding.
Nothing looks different in the bedroom. Your jewelry is still in the drawer. I'll check the rest of the house, just in case.
I'm coming home. Polly is staring at Marissa, clearly riveted by the half of the conversation she can overhear. Marissa slams down the receiver to the store phone and doesn't bother bidding Polly goodbye. Marissa runs straight out the door. She dials Matthew from her car. Matthew, that guy who assaulted you, could it be him?
No way,
Matthew says firmly. Marissa slams on the brakes as she approaches a red light. She's driving too fast. She needs to get herself under control. Why? Why couldn't it be him?
Come on, Marissa. The police said it was probably a random attack. I was just in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Marissa's breathing sounds ragged even to her own ears. But he didn't mug you, and whoever broke in didn't take anything. Someone is obviously after something.
We're safe, babe. No one messes with me or my family.
The steel of his voice grounds her. Matthew is a fighter, she reminds herself. Where's Bennett?
He's in the kitchen. He's fine.
Marissa blinks hard against the tears spilling down her cheeks.
Almost there,
she whispers. Marissa holds on to the vision of Matthew and Bennett together, looking at pictures of dinosaurs for the rest of her short drive. She hurries into the house and finds them together at the kitchen island, just as she'd imagined.
Mom's home!
Matthew shouts, his voice surprisingly joyful. He must be trying to normalize things for Bennett. Marissa gives them each a quick, hard hug, then bends down to get a closer look at the image Bennett is considering on the laptop.
It's a coelophysis, he explains. They were in the Triassic.
He looks fierce,
Bennett nods. He's a carnivore. The kitchen seems exactly as she left it. Surely if someone had broken in, she'd be able to sense an intrusion. But maybe she's giving herself too much credit. She misjudges people all the time. She underestimated Natalie's animosity toward her, and she still can't get a handle on Polly. And she never thought Skip would become so... She shies away from the word, but it's the correct one. Obsessive. Bennett is looking up at Marissa with a solemn expression.
her intuitive son probably senses her stress. Even though Matthew assured her nothing was taken, Marissa wants to see for herself.
I'm just going to run upstairs for a second. Be right back.
She checks the bedroom first, then her office and the guest rooms. Bennett's room is last. Everything is as it should be. One of his dresser drawers is open. Bennett never remembers to shut them, and his blue comforter is stretched neatly across his race car bed. At the far end of the room, the closet door is shut. Marissa stares at it, feeling goosebumps rise on her arms. Surely, when Matthew made sure nothing had been taken, he also ensured no one was still inside the house. He said he'd check. He must have looked in all the closets. A thought enters her mind. It's irrational, yet she can't ignore it. What if Matthew somehow overlooked this one? She's tempted to call downstairs to ask him, but their home is solidly built and noise doesn't travel easily between the floors. Plus, her mouth is now so dry it feels as if it would be difficult to form words. She could run downstairs and ask Matthew to check with her, but that seems like an overreaction. She steps farther into the room, her feet sinking into the thick carpeting. She reaches the door and puts her hand on the knob, but she can't bring herself to turn it. So many horrible, jarring things have happened to them lately. She can't help but think she set this all in motion. Their lives were so simple before she cheated on Matthew with Skip.
No one messes with me or my family,
Matthew had vowed. Marissa is certain he meant those words with everything he had. The thought gives her the strength to fling open the door. The sudden motion makes a few of Bennett's shirts flutter on their hangers, but otherwise everything is exactly as it should be. The rush of relief she feels is so intense that Marissa wants to sink to the floor, but she forces herself to head back downstairs. Bennett and Matthew are just as she left them, their two blonde heads side by side, now considering different dinosaurs from the Jurassic era.
Come on, nothing beats the king,
Matthew is saying.
The T-Rex could crush a car in its jaws.
I still like the Brachiosaurus the best.
Bennett's voice is small.
Which one is the Brachiosaurus?
Bennett turns the screen so Marissa can view it.
His neck is really long, like a giraffe's. It was tough for them because they're so big, but they were herbivores. They probably had to spend almost all of their time finding food, and they couldn't defend themselves well.
Of course, her sensitive boy would tilt toward an equally gentle creature.
Marissa, we've got a few cardboard boxes in the basement, right?
Matthew pushes back his stool.
I'll go grab one for your diorama base.
Marissa takes a glass from a cabinet and fills it with water, then gulps it down. When she turns around, Bennett is back to studying the computer screen, chewing on the inside of his cheek as he always does when he is concentrating. Then he sticks his left hand, the one without the bandage, into the pocket of his jeans. He pops a small object into his mouth. Marissa looks more closely at her son. Bennett isn't chewing on the inside of his cheek.
What are you eating, sweetie?
He ducks his head.
Come on, silly, I saw you.
Marissa sticks out her tongue. Bennett laughs and does the same. A round white candy is on his little tongue. Bennett already had ice cream today. He knows a second sugary treat is against the rules. Plus, where would he even get candy? As if to answer her unspoken question, he pulls a roll of lifesavers out of his pocket. Wintergreen lifesavers. The kind Skip has carried around ever since she's known him. Marissa stares at it for a beat.
Did Uncle Skip give those to you last night?
It's exactly the kind of thing Skip would do. He's always been kind to Bennett. And people without kids don't always think about the effects of sugar on young children. Bennett shakes his head.
I found them.
Bennett! Marissa stretches out her hand and Bennett puts the half-eaten roll in her palm.
Where? At the park?
No, Dad's office.
Matthew comes into the kitchen holding a big cardboard box.
What's going on?
Bennett found these. Marissa holds up the candy. Matthew shrugs.
Guess Skip dropped them last night.
Marissa forces a smile, even though the sound of Skip's name makes her stomach clench.
So, can I have them?
Bennett asks.
No,
Marissa and Matthew say in unison.
Maybe a few after dinner.
Matthew concedes.
But only if you eat something green, like a pile of broccoli taller than a tree.
Matthew tickles Bennett, who laughs and squirms away.
Marissa's fingers close around the hard roll. A thought comes to her. It's so insane she almost doesn't ask the question. Then she does.
Were you and Skip in your office last night?
Matthew pauses and flattening out the box.
Huh? No, we just hung out in the living room and kitchen.
He looks at her quizzically, then appears to grasp the reason for her question.
Oh, maybe Skip wandered in there for some reason when I ran upstairs to tell Bennett his pizza was ready. Maybe he had to make a private call or something.
Marissa nods. That must be it. As Matthew reaches for a ruler and he and Bennett begin discussing how big to make the cardboard base, Marissa glances in the direction of Matthew's office. If someone wanted to break into the house, the office, which faces the leafy side yard, would seem like the easiest entry point. Enough, Marissa tells herself sharply. She isn't thinking straight. Her mind isn't reliable right now. Skip has no connection to the open window in Matthew's study. Skip was a guest in their home last night, not an intruder this morning. If he wandered into the office last night and dropped the roll of candy, it was because he bent over to tie his shoe or something, not because he was wrestling with one of the windows. Matthew reaches over and begins to massage Marissa's neck. She can feel the tightness of the cords under his strong fingers.
You okay, babe?
I didn't sleep well. It isn't a fib. Although she fell asleep shortly after climbing into bed, she awoke in the middle of the night and tossed and turned until she finally rose at a little after 5 a.m.
Why don't you take a nap? Bennett and I will tackle the dinosaurs.
She doesn't want to leave her little family. She yearns to be here, in the cocoon of the kitchen, shaping warm clay in her hands as the three of them create an imaginary world.
We can't have you stressed and tired for tomorrow night, and I can't wait to see you in whatever you picked up from the store.
Matthew's voice drops to a low whisper.
And get you out of it.
Marissa briefly squeezes her eyes shut. She doesn't have any outfits Matthew has never seen. She could tell Matthew a partial truth about why she rushed off to Coco, filling him in on the disturbing Natalie-Polly connection. But she is not going to spend her anniversary talking about Natalie. She'll have to come up with a plausible-sounding reason for wearing something she already owns to their special dinner, she thinks. An excuse, a fib, smoothing things over for the sake of appearances. I should just call it what it is, she thinks. I'm lying to my husband. Something I've learned to do well.
Chapter 38, Avery. I'm in luck. The Whistler Bar and Grill opens at noon on Saturdays. I need to confirm what I strongly suspect, that Chris Bishop, Matthew's father, was sneaking around the dock while Matthew and I spoke. The question is, did Chris go to see his son, whom he's supposedly estranged from? Or was he following me? I've already determined that the Whistler is four blocks from Chris's office on 16th Street in Northwest DC. If the axiom is true, like father, like son, it's possible Chris also stops in at a regular place after work for a meal or a couple of his favorite drinks, and men talk to bartenders the way women talk to hairdressers. I know I can't simply barge in and act all nosy about one of their customers. That's why I ran a few errands first. Now I sit in my car, parked at a street meter outside the bar, assembling my props. I pull out the flimsy fake leather wallet I just purchased at CVS. It seems like something Chris might actually own, given his predilection for cheap options, and remove all the cash I have in my own billfold, a grand total of $24, tucking the money inside. The wallet looks a little pathetic, even if it's one I'm claiming to have found in a nearby parking lot. So I contribute an old Metro card of mine, a business card I picked up the other day for a new nail salon in my neighborhood, and a few random receipts I grabbed out of a trash can at CVS. I just have to hope whomever I hand it off to won't examine the contents too closely. Which leads me to the final items, ones I hope the bartender will take a good look at. What sort of grandfather would Chris be without a few family photos? It was easy to buy a USB cord at CVS and use it to attach my phone to the photo printing machine at the back of the store. I made prints of photographs I already have, the ones I surreptitiously snapped with my phone when I was standing in front of the bishop's bookshelf during our second session. It took a bit of cropping and filtering, but I ended up with reasonable facsimiles of the black and white wedding shot of Marissa and Matthew surrounded by their wedding party, as well as an image of Chris, Matthew, and Bennett, three generations of Bishop men, standing in front of a Christmas tree. I maneuver the prints into the clear plastic inserts in the wallet, then check my appearance in my rearview mirror. I'm still in the jeans and black jacket I wore to meet Marissa in the park and Matthew on his boat, but I've tied my hair back in a knot and I'm wearing glasses with non-prescription lenses and cherry red frames, which I also purchased at the drugstore for $14.99. If someone were to describe the way I look right now, the glasses would be the main thing they'd remember. I step out of my car and walk toward the restaurant, bending the wallet back and forth in my hands so that it seems more worn. It's still a little too new-looking, so just before I reach the door of the Whistler, I drop it on the sidewalk and grind my heel into it. I scoop it back up, pull open the door, and blink as my eyes adjust to the dimly lit restaurant. It's a dive, old darkwood furniture, dust motes swirling through the few beams of sunshine streaming in through a dirty window, with the smell of old beer spills and even older cooking grease. A half dozen or so customers are at tables and booths. Two servers stand behind the long wood bar, talking. One is a youngish-looking man with a mustache, and the other a middle-aged woman with bleached blonde hair. Women typically have better memories for faces than men, so I claim an empty bar stool closer to the female server. "Get you something, hon?" she asks. As long as I'm here, I'd love a Michelob, but I actually came by for another reason. She flips off the cap and puts the bottle in front of me, then narrows her eyes. "I'm trying to figure out if you're the type who wants a glass." By way of answer, I tilt up my beer and sip from the bottle. "So what's the other reason?" The bartender with the mustache is listening to us, but I don't blame him. Not much else is happening in this rundown place. I lay the wallet next to my beer. "I found this in the parking lot of a CVS. I wanted to return it, but there's no ID. The only thing I could find was a receipt from here." I pull out the receipt and hand it to her. "Let me see." She pulls up the reading glasses on a chain around her neck and peers through them. "Yeah, that's us. Two Clooney and sodas. There's a few family photos, too. Maybe you'll recognize him, or her, the owner of the wallet." I tap on the wallet, indicating the plastic sleeve with the photos. "Fancy," she mutters as she looks at the wedding portrait. Then she flips to the one in front of the Christmas tree. "Son of a gun, that's Chris Bishop. Now don't we look all festive?" I take another sip of beer, trying to strike the right affect. Interested, but not overly. "So you know him?" "Oh yeah, he comes in here pretty often. I've probably served him hundreds of Clooneys over the years." So it was him. I bet Chris followed me from the parking lot of the park to the boat. I left immediately after my phone call to Matthew, and Chris's LeSabre was still in the lot. I was so intent on moving forward toward Matthew's surprising destination, I never looked back. Maybe Chris was tracking me before that, too. From the Cub Scout gathering on the grass to my car. He acted strangely when he introduced himself. If he recognized me from the Post article or other interviews I've done, why wouldn't he simply ask? Perhaps his curiosity was piqued when he saw me interacting with Marissa. He could rightly assume she's one of my clients. But there's no universe in which a normal reaction to that discovery would result in his following me. Why not simply ask his daughter-in-law? "Thanks for dropping this off. I'll get it back to him." The server flips back to the wedding photo, then notices the cash. I should pocket this to make up for all the $1 tips he's left over the years. "Keep her talking," I think to myself. "Oh, one of those," I say, grateful I've got an emergency 20 in my makeup bag so I can leave a generous tip when I get my bill. The last thing I want to do is pay with a credit card and leave a clue for Chris. "He's all right. Bit of a loner." The other server, who has inched closer to us, interjects, "Not last time he was in, Darlene. I'm actually the one who served him those Clooneys. Chris met someone here." "Really?" she frowns. I let my gaze drift away. Their conversation will be more uninhibited if I appear to disengage.
Yeah, I think it might have been his son. I didn't even know he had kids till I saw those pictures. He never mentioned a son.
Before I came here, I cross-referenced the date on the receipt. It was the same night I had my second session with the bishops, the one we arranged for at 9 p.m. in their home because Matthew said he had a work event. But the time on the receipt was 8:17, so Matthew could easily have had a drink with his father first. And when Matthew opened the front door for me, I smelled alcohol on his breath.
"Want to see a menu, hon?"
Darlene offers.
This conversational topic has played itself out. I can tell she's ready to move on.
But I'm not. I point to Matthew standing beside his father in the wedding photo and look at the mail server.
Was he here with this guy?
Could have been, he shrugs.
I flip to the more recent photo of Matthew with his dad and son.
Him?
Darlene shoots me a strange look.
No, definitely not that one.
Goosebumps appear on my skin. It's as if my body knows what is coming before my brain recognizes it. One person has been woven through every single one of my sessions with the bishops. Sometimes he's invisible, sometimes he surfaces at unexpected moments. He's linked to both Matthew and Marissa, to Natalie, possibly Marissa's assistant, Polly, and to me. He isn't just the stitch connecting me to the bishops. He's the whole damn spool of thread. I slowly flip over the photograph again, aware that Darlene is staring at me with sharp eyes. Him. The mail server looks down at the wedding picture, tracking to where my index finger is pointing. I've singled out another tall, smiling, light-haired man in a tuxedo. Not the one next to the beautiful bride, but one on the periphery of the image. Electricity shoots through my body. I'm getting closer to the axis of the mystery. I can sense it. Darlene clears her throat. Maybe I ought to find Chris's phone number and tell him about the Good Samaritan who came here to drop off his wallet. I ignore her and keep my eyes on the mail server, barely breathing.
Yeah, he finally says. I think that's him.
My finger is pointing to Skip.